Good morning and welcome everyone to episode 14 of Coffee with the Coder. And we have our guest expert today, Heather Bryans. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning, everyone.
We're delighted that you're able to address a bunch of questions for us this morning. Heather, are you ready to get started?
I am. Let's get ready.
All right. Now, our first question is from Anonymous. This person has been hearing it mentioned that the BMI might have changed to 35 mm-hmm. for morbid obesity, and so they're a little bit confused. Could you address that for us?
Sure. Right. So this actually comes from a document that was created by the National Institute of Health, or the NIH, and it's called the Practical Guide to Identification, Evaluation, and the Treatment of Overweight and Obesity in Adults. And basically what this document says is that a patient with a BMI of 40 or higher, or a patient with a BMI of 35 or higher with certain comorbidities is considered clinically morbidly obese. And in the article, which you can find on the NIH's website, they indicate that there are certain diagnoses that are considered obesity-related. In other words, there are comorbidities or conditions that the patient's obesity may have led to or could have affected in some way. And these comorbidities include things like diabetes, heart disease, sleep apnea, osteoarthritis of the weight-bearing joints, or hypertension. And when these conditions are linked in the documentation with a BMI of 35 or greater, they can provide cause and support the morbid obesity diagnosis. Now, that's not to say that just because a patient's BMI is 35 or more, that we should automatically code that morbid obesity based solely on just that number. The ability to code the morbid obesity would depend on the documentation provided. The physician would need to indicate that the patient was morbidly obese, and we would need to see clear documentation of that, and we'd also need to see the obesity clearly linked to the comorbidity. And note, we can always query the physician if the clinical evidence appears to support the diagnosis, but he's just not being real clear. But as always in coding, our key is documentation, and we can't make assumptions or links ourselves because as coders, we're not clinical. So what I took from that NIH document is that the idea behind the guideline of a BMI of 35 plus with certain comorbidities is that when a physician is determining if a patient is morbidly obese, they're taking into account the overall risk of some diseases or risk factors associated with obese patients, and they're placing them at a higher risk for mortality than others. So, for example, let's say you had one patient with a BMI of 35 who had diabetes and arterial sclerosis and hypertension, and at the same time you have another patient who has a BMI the same, 35, but they don't have any of those associated health conditions. I think you can see sort of pretty clearly that the patient with those associated conditions is at a higher risk than the patient who doesn't have those conditions, so they might fit that morbid obesity diagnosis while the other wouldn't. But again, coding morbid obesity, no matter what the BMI, should be based on the physician's documentation, because that documentation has to support our code.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate that, the way that you outlined that for us so we can understand that better. Those of us who weren't totally clear on it at the beginning. Now we're going to pop over to a medical practice in Georgia. And Mary has a question. It's an OBGYN practice, and sometimes they get a call from the hospital that there's an OB patient there, and the hospital believes the patient to be in labor. The doctor tells them, put her on an NFT, the fetal non-stress test, and then he doesn't go in to the hospital. And this question is, can we even bill for an outpatient hospital visit? There isn't a note. Can we bill for the NFT with a 26, even if the physician did not go interpret it? And just to clarify, the physician did not go to the hospital. The nurse tells the physician whether the NFT is reactive or non-reactive.
Right. Okay, so we did a little bit of research on this, and we were not able to find a definitive or a formal answer, but our team did find several published articles related to the topic. And basically what the article indicates is that to separately bill for the service with the 59025, which is for the fetal non-stress test, your OBGYN has to document a clear indication for doing the NST. For instance, maybe they needed to measure the fetal well-being, something along those lines. In addition to that documentation, you'll also need to have a report with the findings and a recommendation for further testing or treatment. And in addition to all of that, you should also have a hard copy of the test strip. So that's what we found.
Thank you. And now I'm going to turn to an inpatient rehab. It's two questions from Tabitha in Florida, but they're really the same question in two scenarios. So I'm going to go ahead and read you both of them. In the first scenario, the patient comes to the acute after having a cardiac arrest, I-46.9. Is this something we should carry over to the rehab as a comorbidity? And in the second scenario, the patient has respiratory failure with hypoxia in an acute setting, which is J96.90. Is that something we should carry over to the rehab as a comorbidity?
Okay, so I would need to see the record and the documentation to see what exactly is documented there. But for rehab, only the conditions that are reported as comorbidities in the rehab setting are diagnosed. There are diagnoses that still exist that are treated or impact treatment or extended length of stay. That's what you're going to report on the IRF-PI. So if the cardiac arrest or the respiratory failure were not actually present in the rehab encounter, meaning that we're not actually doing anything for those conditions anymore, they would not be reported unless they were the etiological diagnosis. Because remember, the etiologic can be resolved, and we're dealing with the residuals in rehab. So based on the documentation, if the respiratory failure is no longer acute and it's not the reason for the encounter, like the etiologic, you would report it as chronic if it was chronic on the IRF-PI as a comorbidity. And for the cardiac arrest code, I would use, if it was no longer present, I would use the Z86.74 code, which would be more appropriate in this case because it's a report. It's a code for reporting personal history of a cardiac arrest.
Ah, thank you. Okay, now we have one more. I'm pretty sure we have time for one more. So we'll go to another inpatient rehab. This one's in Texas. And Victoria's in a quandary over how best to report this scenario. And she's asking for IDC, EDO, and rehab diagnosis. The patient had a traumatic fall, which caused a traumatic hematoma. The hematoma was extensively debrided, and now the right knee has an open wound and cellulitis. The patient was at the LTAC, or the long-term acute care, for wound procedure and care. Now they're debilitated, and they've come to the IRF for weakness, continued wound care, and IV antibiotics. So the actual question from here is, what is the best IGC, EDO, and rehab diagnosis? But there's so many different opinions about which codes I'm supposed to be using. And it was an open wound.
Okay. All right, so this one is a little bit tricky, but according to CMS, the etiologic diagnosis is the problem that led to the condition that's represented by the IGC. So by using that definition, the traumatic hematoma, which would be a contusion code S80.01XA, is what caused the entire situation. However, if the physician documents that the infection and not the hematoma is what caused the patient's decline and overall debility, the infection would be the etiologic, and that would be code L03.115 for the cellulitis of the right lower limb, plus an organism code if one was stated. And that's just another consideration here that we need to think about. Was the cellulitis a surgical complication or a post-op infection? If that was the case, that would cause the etiologic to be T81.4XXA for an infection following the procedure. Now, I'm sure you discussed all of those options. And what it all comes down to is how the physician tells the story. Was it a hematoma that caused the debility, or was it the infection, and was the infection documented as postoperative? Well, given the information you provided, the impairment, the reason, or the focus of treatment is debility, and I would put that case in IGC-16. But your etiologic is going to depend on the documentation itself and what the doctor says.
It always comes to that, doesn't it? No matter what the setting, it always comes down to what the doctor said. thank you, Heather. We appreciate all that. Exactly. Well, now it's time for us to have a winner for today, and I have all these names in my virtual hat here on my desk. So I'm spinning around, and I will select a winner here. And today's winner is Victoria from Texas. So we're happy that you've joined us, Victoria. I'm going to send you an email and ask you how to get your official mug to you, and we'd love to have your mug shot once you get it. Thanks, everyone, for being here today. The next session will be Monday, July 3rd, which is 2 weeks from now.